Okay, Marshall, please call the next case.
Now calling A230682, Evelyn M. Marsh, petitioner, respondent, versus Eric Napon, appellant.
Good morning.
Yes.
Thank you. You can go ahead and sit down. I'm presiding judge today, Sarah Wheelock, and I'm sitting with Judges Bratvold and Judge Smith. And we are ready to hear the third case on our calendar today. So just a reminder, you each have 15 minutes to present your argument. Appellant will go first and then have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. At the beginning of your argument, we are recording the audio, and we will have that available within about 24 hours on the Judicial Branch's website. So when you begin, please state your name for the record, identify the client that you represent, and let us know if there are any pronunciations or pronouns that we should be aware of, and we're ready to hear the case. So counsel for appellant, please feel free to adjust the podium as well, up or down. And the microphone does move as well. We have 15 minutes on the clock, and we're ready when you are.
Thank you, Anna. You know, my name is Eric Anonobi. I represent the appellant in this matter. The appellant is Mr. Eric Napon. You know, we are here because we filed this appeal, and obviously I'm going to be relying on the brief, the appellate brief, and the reply brief filed in this matter. You know, your honors, the facts are very simple. First of all, I want to say that the statutory scheme of the Order for Protection Rules, which I think is Minnesota Statute 518.01B, is just designed to protect people from danger, designed to protect people in a domestic situation from danger, people that potentially could get hurt physically or even get killed. And that's the aim of the statute, to protect. Your Honor, the statute was never designed to be used by people to fight unnecessary wars that are not contemplated within the statute. So the facts of this case are simple. The appellant, the respondent, had filed a petition for order for protection, and in her petition, she made various allegations of physical abuses that have been done to her over the years, starting from 2013. As a matter of fact, she stated that she had been beaten up. She had woken up sometimes in the night to find the respondent with a knife standing over her. She stated a number of times the respondent appeared to have hit her or punched her, and she also stated that she went to the hospital but somehow lied about the fact that she was hit at the hospital. Your Honor, with all of these facts that she presented, she came to court, and obviously she was given an ex parte order at the beginning. The respondent had to file for a hearing because the respondent was astonished. Now, in the course of the hearing, petitioner, who was the respondent in this case, now brought up additional information, but more importantly, all the evidence that she presented at the trial did not support her case at all. In fact, most of the things she stated in her case, in the order for protection, were actually unsupported by evidence. And where there were a few things that were submitted, things that were in the nature of photographs, they did not even point to the fact that you could tie it to the appellant. In other words, you could not tie the fact that the photographs, some of the photographs were blurry, some of the photographs did not, all the photographs did not have timelines or timestamps in which they happened. There was no supporting memorandum stating that these things happened at this time. There was no statement, there was nothing to show that it was ever reported to anybody. It was not reported to the police. It was not reported to anybody who should know. All that the respondent stated was that in her culture, that they don't normally report things. On one hand, she said they don't report things in her culture. On the other hand, she said she was protecting the appellant. On another occasion, again, she said, you know, she was concerned about her personality in the community because she felt that her reputation was such that she couldn't report anything. So in all of these things that were alleged, they came before the court for the hearing. Your Honors, the appellant came to the court, presented his evidence, called several witnesses, presented documents. And after all of these things, it was obvious that there were contradictions in the statements of the witnesses for the respondent. They contradicted themselves severally.
So, counsel, you understand our standard of review.
Yes, I do.
On a factual finding.
Yes, sir.
And we don't reweigh the evidence, we don't resolve conflicts, even if a district court believes a person's testimony.
Yes, sir.
Why isn't that not sufficient to sustain the finding under our very deferential standard of review?
And I appreciate that, Your Honors. Mm-hmm. The problem was that the trial court, and that was where I was going to go to, the trial court abused her discretion, with all respect. She abused the discretion because her findings were not backed by the record. And her findings, to a large extent, were not based on weighing both sides of the case. Her finding was just based on what one party said.
And why is that not permissible for a judge, a fact finder, to believe one person?
Because there are two sides to a case. It is expected and presumed by law that the trial judge should have regard to all the evidence presented on both sides, evaluate all this evidence, and make findings based on the evidence of both sides. That is what the jury actually would do in a jury trial. They listen to both sides, evaluate the evidence, and come to a resolution. But when somebody, it's dangerous when a court decides that, refuses to consider the other side and just evaluates one side and comes to a conclusion, because there are grave implications to the party who loses on this order for protection. This order for protection affects lives. It affects the person to whom it is given against. That person has consequences flowing from there. And so it is expected by the law itself that before the court comes to that conclusion, in fairness to everybody, it must evaluate all sides to the case. And that's what we are complaining about. We are complaining because the district court made erroneous findings, actually abused that discretion. As a matter of fact, if you look at the briefs that have been filed, you'll find that the trial court respectfully probably did not listen very well, because she mischaracterized a lot of the evidence in contradiction to the transcripts themselves. She mischaracterized the evidence, said things that were not said, gave credit to hearsay evidence, came to a conclusion almost like this: everything the respondent said or everything the appellant said did not matter. So, and so that's where we're coming to the Court of Appeal.
Make sure I understand your argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So it is not uncommon when we hear a case for an order for protection that our review of the record shows, just like it does here, that there are basically, as you just said, two sides to the story that were presented to the district court.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that is exactly what the district court then resolves by deciding which of the two sides is more believable, credible, what actually happened. This court doesn't second guess that analysis, the district court's analysis. So maybe it sounds like I'm just repeating what Judge Smith asked you earlier, but I'm struggling to understand what the issue is for this court on review.
Your Honor, this court has the power to review the findings of the district court.
But we defer to credibility findings of the district court generally. And here,
yes, sir,
we actually have very specific credibility findings with reasonings,
yes, sir,
by the district court,
yes,
where,
sir,
for instance, the judge considered your argument on behalf of your client that Ms. Marsh made no police reports, contemporaneous police reports, or visits to the hospital or other medical treatment for many of the injuries she received. The district court did consider that and rejected it.
You know, the district court did not consider the evidence provided by the appellant. The district court's decision, if you look at the decision, everything about her decision was all about what the respondent said.
So when you argue that, counsel, what I'm hearing is because my client lost, the district court didn't consider the evidence. And that's not how our review works. So you need to defend your argument in a more thorough fashion.
Okay, Your Honor, what I'm trying to say is that essentially when the district court considered the findings, she did not make specific references to the testimony and to the witnesses that were called by the appellant. Furthermore, there were contradictions in the evidence given by the witnesses for the respondent. The district court did not make any findings as to these contradictions in their evidence. For example, some of the witnesses were saying one thing, and the district court was not considering that they were contradicting themselves. So in all of that...
Would you be specific, counsel?
Okay, yes, I'll be specific, Your
Honor.
Thank you. For example, when it came to the issue of the witness for the respondent, that was her younger brother. The court did not consider, first of all, that the younger brother was saying something different from what the petitioner, from what the respondent was saying. The younger brother was saying that, you know, on the day in question, the appellant was hitting the head of the respondent on the wall in the living room. But the respondent herself, who was affected, stated that nothing of that sort. She stated that they had an argument inside the bedroom and that appellant kind of pushed her around and pushed her on the bed. That was completely different from what her witness said. Her witness, her younger brother, stated that he was hitting her head in the living room, not in the bedroom. Your Honors, those things are the consequences of statements that have been rehearsed, but somehow do not add together. Secondly, Your Honors, the respondent on one of our cases, said that her hands were twisted and that she suffered a swollen hand. On another occasion, on the same incident, she stated that her hands were fractured. In other words, she alleged in her petition that her hands were fractured, but when it came to giving evidence, she said her hand was swollen.
Let's go back to the brother's testimony just quickly. In the district court's decision, and I'm looking at the second page, I think it's probably addendum 5, bottom of that page, so it's 2 of 8 on the findings. The district court says that it finds Mr. Marsh's, and that's the brother, testimony credible as he was frank in his confusion and specific in his testimony. Respondents' attempts, meaning your client's attempts, to discredit Mr. Marsh are biased toward, as biased toward his sister, were not convincing.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Marsh was even and measured in his testimony and described one incident and how confused and surprised he was by respondent's behavior.
Yes, sir.
So it sounds, when I read this, the district court clearly considered your argument, you know, the argument made below, that there was some contention or contradiction between the witnesses about this incident. And the district court said, thought about this, and Mr. Marsh's testimony is credible. So we have that decision resolved, that question resolved, and it's supported by the evidence. And that's really how our standard of review works. So tell me why I'm wrong. That's what I'm waiting for.
Yeah, with all respect, okay. Your Honor, the fact that the district court did not even draw any reference to the contradiction of what Mr. Marsh said versus
because
what
it didn't find contradictions. It credited Mr. Marsh's testimony.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right.
Yes, Your Honor, but in crediting his testimony, Your Honor, he didn't make any reference to the fact that he was saying something different from what the respondent was saying. But beyond even that testimony, Your Honor, there were several evidences of where the respondent would state that she was injured and she would bring up photographs. And those photographs had no connection. Your Honor, evidence is not, findings are not based on nothing. Credibility findings have to be based on facts. They are not based on just what a district court might think or a district court might want to do. It's based on facts. And those facts have to be logical, have to be credible and reasonable. And so in situations like this, where a district court is giving findings that are either contradictory, are making findings on evidence that is either contradictory or evidence that is not supported, Your Honor, this court has a duty to be able to say that on the basis of the records, it does not come together. It's not logical. Your Honor, secondly, I mentioned about the things that were the injuries. Your Honor, even in spite of this, there was no evidence that anything was taken to the police or anything was reported to the police. There was also nothing to show. There was no evidence to show that the respondent had the injuries that she had. Because she claims again, on one hand, that she went to the hospital and she lied to them and told them that, and didn't tell them what really happened to her. Your Honor, this is something that should give room for pause. If a witness or if a complaining person would go to the hospital and make false allegations to the hospital, part of what we say in the law of hearsay is that medical records are reliable because for reasons of hearsay, we don't expect patients to lie, and they are very credible. If a witness who's coming to ask the court for a favor is actually stating that she went to the hospital and lied about what actually happened to her, then the question becomes, what then is truth and what then is false? And so she had nothing to support the fact that these injuries happened. The other things that she testified about was that her glasses were broken. She testified that the appellant stole money from her account, $40,000. There was evidence that was brought in at the trial from a bank manager who testified that there was nothing stolen from any account. Your Honor, when you look at these things, they implicate the honesty of the petitioner and what the petitioner is trying to accomplish.
And you'll have another 5 minutes for rebuttal, counsel.
All right, Your Honor.
Yes.
Your Honor, in addition, this petitioner stated that she lost some pregnancy when there was no pregnancy lost. She stated that she left the house out of fear. Your Honors, the evidence showed during cross-examination that she did not leave the house until after the appellant had left the house. Mm-hmm. And so the picture being painted were so clear that it was something being made up. She made allegations that...
And I'm going to have to stop you because we're over time. Okay. So, but there will be an initial 5 minutes for rebuttal. Yes, so we will turn next to counsel for the respondent.
All right.
So again, feel free to adjust the podium. And we have 15 minutes, so you may begin when you are ready.
May it please the court. I'm Karen Cole, and I represent the respondent in this case, Evelyn Marsh. The Peshovnik case states the basic rule that applies here, and that is where the evidence is conflicting or where it's a question of witness credibility, the district court has discretion. That rule controls. In this case, my client brought the petition, and her petition was precipitated by the events that occurred in October of 22. Her testimony, that was an occasion where the appellant twisted her arm behind her back to the point where she believed her arm would be broken. The district court specifically found her testimony credible. In this case, we have more. The district court would have been justified in issuing an order based on the October events alone and the October evidence. But in this case, there are all the additional incidents of abuse that go back to 2013. And all of that abuse taken together paints a picture of continued abuse by the appellant. The district court's reasoning as to each of those incidents was detailed and the district court explained the reasons for its determination of credibility. Just as Your Honor recognized in the case of the younger brother, the court explained his confusion, why it was that the court found his testimony credible. And in fact, the court laid out the reasons it found each witness credible. And like all of the cases say, credibility is for the district court to determine. Counsel suggested at one point that physical abuse is needed to support an order for protection. And the case law and the statute says that a fear of imminent harm is also a basis for an order. And here we have both. We have physical injury and we have fear. We have a woman waking up at 2 a.m. with the appellant standing over her holding a knife. And we have all the instances of physical abuse, all of the injuries that are documented and corroborated by the photographs, by the testimony of the other witnesses. Counsel suggests and in his brief contends that my client's testimony was not credible because she did not report the abuse to police. And of course, there is no requirement that an OFP petitioner do that. And in this case, my client gave very good reasons why she did not go to police. She was concerned about the effect on her business. She was afraid. She was concerned about her standing in the community where she is a community leader, and she was afraid. And when it comes to the medical evidence, my client admitted that she did not tell the whole truth, and she lied to the medical staff at the ER. And again, she admitted that she lied, and she explained why it was that she lied. And the court laid that out in its decision. It explains, it noted her testimony that she was afraid of the appellant. The other side's brief, on I believe page 22 or so, lays out six indicia of persuasion. Six indicia the court should look at in deciding whether or not a party's position is persuasive. And the court lays out why in finding, I believe it's eight, why each of those six indicia was satisfied here. The detail of my client's testimony, the fact that it was supported by other witnesses whose testimony the court specifically found credible, an entire pattern of abuse that goes back to 2013, and the photographs. All of it taken together show and support the district court's decision that my client's position was persuasive and justified an order for protection. At one point, just now, opposing counsel mentioned that my client did not leave the party's home until after the appellant left the home. In this case, the evidence shows that my client went to a safe house. She went to safe places every night so that she was not there alone. And she also noted that the appellant had been basically stalking her, watching her residence at night, sitting in his car in the parking lot of her workplace, and asking others at their church where she was. So the fact that she left the home place after he did is of no import. As I said, all of the six indicia the court laid out supports my client's position, supports the district court's finding, and the weight of the evidence taken as a whole amply supports her position. If the court has no questions for me, I'll conclude.
Okay. I don't see any questions. Thank you, counsel. We appreciate your argument. Okay, and the clock has been reset for 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Yes, ma'am.
And counsel for appellant, you can go ahead and begin when you are ready, and I'll let you know when the 5 minutes is up.
That's fine. Your Honor, I'll just briefly reply to just what she said about, you know, when the appellant left the house. The appellant left the house before the respondent left. And so this statement is incorrect, and the records will bear this out. I'll rely on the brief, I'll rely on the records, the transcripts, and even the testimony of the respondent. The appellant left before the respondent went to any safe house. And so what the court should find interesting is, why would an order for protection be filed 4 months after an appellant has left the house? But that's one point. You know, back to the question you asked regarding the basis of appellate discretion here, the basis of appellate review here. You know, a district court, and this is a court of appeal decision, it says a district court abuses its discretion if it misapplies the law or makes findings that are unsupported by the record or resolves the discretionary question in a manner that is contrary to logic and the facts of the on record. And I cited the case here, Whiplinger and Whiplinger. And in such circumstances, Your Honors, the Court of Appeal has a duty to review. Typically, the courts go by the abuse of discretion standard. The courts will not interfere. But where these things happen, where a district court makes findings that are unsupported by the record or resolves the discretionary question, that is her discretion, in a manner that is contrary to logic and the facts on record, then the Court of Appeal will intervene. And the Court of Appeal would look into it to see, you know, to review that decision. You know, and so what we're saying here...
I'm curious, counsel. Yeah. You've mentioned hearsay a couple of times in your principal argument. Are you able to point to specific instances in the record where there was hearsay? And can you tell us if that was objected to at the time?
Absolutely, Your Honor. There was an objection, Your Honor. There was a gentleman called Lee Anderson, a witness that was called by the respondent, called Lee Anderson. He's a reverend. And he testified about things that he said his wife told him. He testified as to what his wife told him. He also testified as to what the respondent told him. And during cross-examination, he was asked whether he witnessed any of those things directly. And he said no, he did not witness them. But then, to our surprise, the district court itself, and that comes to where the Court of Appeal would interfere with the discretion of the district court, the district court herself, in her decision, mischaracterized his evidence, said his evidence related to something different, said his evidence related to an event that happened in 2015. mischaracterized what the man said completely and relied on that to give a decision. And that's what I'm asking your honors to please look at this, because this court has the power to review what the district court has done. When there are findings that are unsupported by the record itself, your honors would find that these things did not happen. They would find that this is not the case. And that's why I'm asking the Court of Appeal to look into these things. Because if a district court makes a mistake, this is a court that can correct that error. So Reverend Lee Anderson gave hearsay evidence completely. He was asked directly whether he witnessed any of these things, and he said no, he did not. He was either acting on what the respondent said or what his wife told him that the respondent said. And that's the circumstance. But above all these things, the respondent provided no evidence whatsoever regarding all the other things that were mentioned. She comes up and says
Did she testify herself?
She testified, yes, Your Honor, but she provided no supporting evidence.
So we do have case law that says that testimony is evidence in and of itself.
I understand that, Your Honors, but when there are when there's evidence from both sides, the court has to have a basis for relying on one side over the other. And that is what was not done here. What was simply done here was that the trial court relied strictly on just one party. Even if the trial court had been able to say, well, this is what Mr. Nyepom testified about, this is what he said, this is the reason why I prefer this one over this one, it will make sense. But, Your Honor, it was all so one-sided, there was nothing to support the trial court's findings except the fact that the trial court had already made up its mind, with all respect. And that is what is troubling, Your Honor, because this order for protection issue could happen to anybody, and anybody could be in trouble for something they've not done. And this is not fair. The reason why we've come this far is because the appellant feels unfairly treated, unjustified. That this is unjustified. Your Honours, I want to also say that in all of what we have seen, the appellant...
We're at time. You can finish your sentence.
Okay. Your Honours, in all we have seen, there's no reason why the appellant will press all these issues but to vindicate his name, because these things did not happen, and that is why we're here. So I'm asking your Honours, please, to exercise the powers you have, look into what this court has done. Is this supported by the record? Is this supported by logic? Is it supported by common sense? And to grant the appeal. Thank you, Your Honours.
Thank you very much. Thank you to both counsel for the briefing and for argument here today. It's been very helpful. And we will take the matter under advisement and issue a decision within the statutory time frame. Thank you.